And welcome to Literary Loitering, part of the Geek Show's podcast network. We are the Geek Show's dedicated books podcast. Normally, we have an Andrew here, do we not?
Yes. He's not a figment of our imagination.
He could be, actually. Have we checked that?
No, we haven't.
He could be a thought form.
Andrew, are you a thought form? No.
That's an uncannily good impersonation too. It's like, if you could just keep doing that for the rest of the show, we could make this sound like a proper three-man show.
Hey, it's better than the impression I did of you the other show.
I mean, your Andrew does sound a bit Kenneth Williams, but I think it's salvageable. It's all right.
I'm going to get Andrew to say matron a lot.
He sounded really exasperated saying that, like he was actually calling for a matron.
Anyway, yes, Graham, I'm Rob, in case
and
you're wondering.
Without Andrew, we have no idea what the blurb is, so if you enjoy listening, good for you, top work.
Yes, it's always fun when one of us is missing.
The best show, therefore, would be if none of us turned up at all. You know, that's three times the fun.
Just an hour of silence.
The John Cale version.
Shall we do that for an episode? Just introduce it as Literary Loitering. All three of us just do it. Then it's just an hour. The rest of it is just silence.
You know what I've done there?
What?
I've mixed up my John Cales and my John Cages.
Yes, you have.
That's a terrible mistake. I don't know. My intellectual credibility is shot to dust after that.
But yeah, I think we should do that at some point. We just introduce Literary Loitering and then just be silenced and us laughing at random times.
That would be terrifying. Just an hour of cackling.
Well, no. Not an hour of solid cackling, just long silences and then just us laughing.
That's even worse.
There's a reason why I write horror. I do it by accident. I don't know how.
Yes, they always start as romantic comedies, don't they?
Not in my case. They just start off as, oh, Timmy went to the shops today to buy a loaf of bread. I want to be a children's author, damn you.
This is exactly what, you know, Poppy Z. Bright and Stephen King scream every night as they look at the ceiling.
See, that would be amazing if we had, like, the children's laureate, Stephen King. Amazing. Oh, no, not Stephen King, sorry. It'd be Clive Barker, because Stephen King's American.
Oh, wow. That would actually be legitimately good. Has Clive Barker written a young adult book or a kid's book? I bet he'd actually be good at it.
Well, it depends on what you define as a young adult or a kid's book. See, when I read Cabal, I always thought it was more of a teenager's novel.
Yeah, I was thinking about that and, you know, the excellent, very underrated movie version, Nightbreed. Yeah. Yeah, that was what put me on the train of thought. So we're settled then. We're going to sign a deal, get the author of Hellraiser to make some kids' books.
If you wanted to do a proper kids' adventure, then Weave World.
Mm.
Weave World is a proper dyed-in-the-wool, Lion Witch in the Wardrobe type adventure.
This is sort of the reason why no one trusts us to babysit, isn't it?
Well, no. I mean, it's not like I'm suggesting the Books of Blood or, you know, Imagica or The Great and Secret Show, any of those other titles, especially not The Great and Secret Show, because that has a kind of disturbing introduction about how a bunch of teenage girls in this county become pregnant all at the same time because of some mystical energy.
Yeah, that's what they all say. They all say mystical energy.
Yes. I'm not suggesting that one. But Weave World is a proper dyed-in-the-wool adventure.
So, from that, shall we somehow pivot onto a story about tax?
Yes. Well, taxes, I have to deal with taxes on an annual basis.
Hmm.
And the thing is, they are very tricky to navigate. It is a lot like the whole analogy, you pull one thread and everything unravels.
Yeah.
and I tied it in.
That's really impressive.
Sorry, I just had to stop and gloat for a second there. But anyway, yeah, the Booksellers Association is calling for an end to Amazon's deeply unfair tax advantages. Kind of agree, but also don't agree.
That's interestingly ambivalent. Go on.
Right. I understand that Amazon have various tax advantages, just like any major retailer does. I mean, Asda, or Walmart, as we should call it, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Tesco's, all of these major supermarkets have certain tax advantages that they get for employing a bunch of people and keeping them off the dole, right?
Yeah.
Amazon is pretty much the same. The Booksellers Association is saying that the tax system, which is being applied to Amazon, you know, forces them to compete against these huge booksellers who can discount the price of books, and it's basically hamstringing booksellers in general. They can't undercut in the way that Amazon does and in the way that all these supermarkets can.
The other major difference between Amazon and something like Tesco as well, of course, is that Tesco employs people.
Yeah.
Amazon seems to have a sort of remote center of operations, a few drones, and warehouses that are run by terrifying far-right groups keeping the immigrant labour in check. Funny how we forgot about that story quite quickly, didn't we? That broke a couple of years back. But
yeah.
And it was happening in Germany too, which, I mean, there isn't an ideal place for neo-Nazis to be, but there is a worst place, and I'd argue that's Germany.
No. I can think of several worse places than Germany.
Well, outside my front door is somewhere that I don't want them either, but
yeah,
go on.
I was going to say, you know, teaching nursery school or primary school education, you know, outside my front door, in my bathtub, you know, eating the food in my fridge.
This sounds like you've got a serious Nazi infestation problem in your house, Bob.
Yeah, I think I need to call an exterminator.
Yes. Which is ironic, as most of the people exterminators around here tend to be Nazis.
Sorry. There's several really, really distasteful jokes. Yes. I could have made when I mentioned the exterminator, and I am holding back from making them.
And then I just leapt in and spoiled it.
No, they were worse than what you said. You know me, Graham. You know how my brain works.
One day I'll tell you the most inappropriate thing I ever laughed at, but I think we'll let it fester in listeners' minds. We'll have it like a box that cannot be opened.
Oh, no. I've heard some horrible jokes. About the war and stuff like that. So, but the 80s were a very different time. Let me put it that way, right? 80s, being a school kid in the 80s was very different. There were no real limits.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the 80s, you had to sort of develop quite a black sense of humour to distract you from the threat of nuclear Armageddon being launched by a senile American president. Whereas now...
Yep.
So, yeah, Amazon's tax business, it's a bit heavy to open a show with, isn't it? I worry that that's the literary loitering equivalent of when everyone went in really excited to see The Phantom Menace, and it begins with this big scrawl about intergalactic tax dodgers.
Well, the Booksellers Association has a point. With the current system, it's heavily weighted against bricks and mortar retailers who are paying something like £2.41 in business rates for every £1 paid in corporation tax.
Yeah.
Right? But Amazon aren't paying that amount. Bedford's Waterstones branch currently pays 17 times more in business rates per square foot than the nearby Amazon distribution center. And the reason why that is because of a fundamental difference in what those businesses are. Amazon never claimed to be a shop. Right?
Yes.
Amazon have always been kind of a warehouse distribution service.
But they have diversified in this strange way, haven't they? Have you seen in the Cleveland Center, they've got that bizarre thing the Amazon collection point.
Yeah, it's one of these strange things that it suddenly appeared, and I thought it was some kind of weird garage door and some strange Cleveland, some strange T-side version of the Batmobile was going to appear from it, and more people, more bunch of people down as it sped its way to the nearest, I don't know, drug bust, which is pretty close to the Cleveland Center, I would say, given that it's Middlesbrough.
But yeah, I just thought that's quite horrifying, isn't it? That's what shop fronts are now. Basically a posh safety deposit box.
It is kind of impersonal.
No physical presence.
Yeah, it is very, very impersonal. But there is something to be said for that level of distance between you and the seller. You don't need to engage in all of the niceties. You can just go there, pick up your book and leave. Pick up your electronics and leave. Pick up whatever it is and leave. And as a guy who, generally, when I go shopping, I like to take my time and have a browse. But when I'm shopping with other people, especially of the opposite gender, I am the typical bloke. You know,
yeah.
Are we done yet? My feet hurt. You know, that kind of thing. Because as much as I like to take my time, it just seems like when I'm out shopping with other people, they take even more time than me.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that happens. I don't know why it happens to a lot of men and even some women. You know, I don't know what the mental switch is, but for some reason where you would be happy browsing around and just having a poke around and spending time shopping if you were by yourself, as soon as you're with somebody else, all of a sudden you're just in a rush all the time.
Yeah. No, that's very true. I can't really add to that. So shall we move on to the only topic which is even sexier and more exciting than tax?
Yes.
Clegg.
No, not Clegg. It's Clegg on Brexit as well, which makes it worse.
Clegg on Brexit just sounds like the least appealing documentary title that you would skip past on the EPG.
No, Brain, I hate you. I hate you, my brain. My brain just conjured up an image of, you know, Brexit, but as like a platform, and Clegg just kind of lying on his side, you know, doing the whole lying on his side pose with his arm propped up his head.
Yes, it's sizzling Clegg on Brexit action. Yes, this is the bodily head have decided that they don't need money this Christmas, evidently, because they are publishing a book by Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister, entitled How to Stop Brexit and Make Britain Great Again.
What?
That subtitle, he really should have thought a bit harder about that, shouldn't he?
I'm concerned about you, Nick. I'm worried that you're going to start doing like four different hairstyles in your hair. And you're going to dye it blonde and dye your skin orange and speak in a very specific way, which is very good. It's very good. It's the best. It's the best way to speak.
I actually saw a story recently where they quoted an anonymous source in the White House who was saying something like, everyone's distracted by the travel ban. Wait till they see the trade deal. It's going to be the best. Believe me, you won't believe it. The best trade deal. And you think, who could this anonymous source be? It's genuinely a challenge to work out their identity.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I've just realised Donald Trump is Naruto.
Whoosh.
Right. Naruto is an anime character, right? And Donald Trump is not. But here are the similarities.
As far as we know.
Hang on. Here are the similarities. Both of them are idiots, right? They both have blonde hair, which looks fake.
I'm Googling this now.
Naruto has a tendency to run around wearing a bright orange jumpsuit. Donald Trump is bright orange. And they both say believe it a lot.
I think the adorable whiskers-style makeup effect on Naruto could only improve Trump's hideous sagging face.
Make it Trump Trump meeting Putin, but with whiskers going, I'm a cat, Putin. I'm a cat, Vladimir.
Legitimately, probably something that he says to Putin anyway, to be honest, as so, part yeah. of the...
There's my anime theory of the day.
So, Clegg on Brexit. You can't get us away from Clegg on Brexit, no matter how hard you try.
Damn it.
Waterstones non-fiction buyer Clement Knox.
Sorry.
I wonder which way Clement Knox voted in the referendum. I mean, I hate to go by stereotypes, but... Yes, he says... The last 12 months have seen the publication of some outstanding politics titles as writers, readers and publishers clamour to understand the total transformation of global politics in what feels like no time at all. In a sense, Clegg was ahead of the curve as his memoir, Politics, great title there, Nick, which was originally intended for publication in the spring of 2016 and was pushed back on account of the Brexit vote, was a meditation on the trials of negotiating the middle ground of British politics. God almighty, nothing says a sexy, exciting read like negotiating the middle ground of British politics.
I have one thing to pick fault with on what he said.
And just that one. Is,
yeah, just one, but it's a big one, right?
Okay.
And that is his use of the word meditation.
What if Clegg has reached enlightenment and the rest of us are just too... caught up in everyday reality to notice.
I'm sorry, but does that mean Clegg is now where he shaved his head and is wearing an orange robe and sitting at the top of Ben Nevis? And
whatever he does, he's going to go back to orange, isn't he?
He's
Trump
gonna go...
or a Buddhist monk.
Exactly. But, you know, he's now like some political sage or something like that.
I think he has failed to reach the state of transcendent self-awareness that enlightenment represents, as his publisher has described the book as the indispensable handbook to saving your country from an utterly pointless calamity.
So
altogether
you said,
now, like the coalition.
Yeah, you said handbook, didn't you?
Yeah.
Right, I thought you said something else, beginning with hand.
we might get onto that later, I guess. Is this just mentioning Trump and Putin's got us on this?
Kind of. Maybe. I don't know. I'm confused. I don't know what's going on anymore. Let's move on.
Yes, Chuck Palahniuk, the author of Fight Club and many other books that I can't remember the title of because it's not 2003 anymore, has left a little present for a Portland, Oregon resident named Jolyn Winter.
Could you not have phrased that better?
In retrospect, there were hundreds of paths I could have chosen.
Sorry, when you said he's left a little present.
It's like he's a pet dog or something.
And that, or he just stopped to use the bathroom.
Chuck Palahniuk has crapped on his neighbour's lawn.
Sorry. Like I keep saying, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
It's very true, but, you know, working a book podcast, when do you ever get the chance to implement any sort of literacy skill?
Oh, no. Anyway,
I feel that this next short paragraph taken from the AV Club will not lead us to any toilet humour whatsoever. Let's go. Winter posted images of the find on Facebook, revealing that the sealed case found in her wall contained a signed copy of Fight Club, a letter about the history of the house, some of Palahniuk's family photos, and the original renovation plans for the bathroom.
Okay, is it Palahniuk or Palahniuk?
It's Palahniuk.
Is it pronounced Palahniuk?
It is.
All right, okay. Because I've always been confused as to how to pronounce his surname.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of quite difficult surnames in American literature. It's also Michael Chabon,
yeah,
rather than Michael Chabon, or however else you pronounce it.
Yeah, I know about that one. It's just with Polanyuk's surname, because of the way it's spelled,
yes.
I've always pronounced it Polanyuk, because it literally is spelled Polanyuk.
Yes. No, that's completely understandable. I have the letter that was found in the time capsule, and it actually addresses the name controversy in perhaps the least helpful way possible. The second paragraph says, "My name is Charles Michael Polanyuk, and I write using the name Chuck Polanyuk." Well, that's an uncrackable code, isn't it?
That's very helpful, Chuck.
So, yeah, what the actual story is, which we might have entertained, explained badly due to our distraction. Yes, he has left a time capsule in the walls of a house that he sold 10 years ago.
See, that's a nice present to leave. And it's better than the one that we thought.
It's definitely an improvement, yes.
I was just thinking, if his house was on the market for 10 years...
It's only grown more fetid in there.
Yes. Oh. No, moving on.
Quickly, yes.
Good omens.
Good omens.
Yes. The acting choices to play the angel and the devil in Good Omens, they've been announced, and the two people who are going to take on the role of the angel, Aziraphale, and the devil, Crowley,
mm-hmm.
you could not have picked two better choices. Michael Sheen is going to play the angel, and David Tennant is going to play the devil.
I mean, that is just spot on, isn't it?
Well, demon, I should say, rather than devil, because Satan is a thing in Good Omens.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, it's two perfect choices.
I am a little sort of more lukewarm on Tennant, but I do think he'll be very good in this role. I just still have sort of lingering problems with how he played the Doctor. But Sheen is absolutely perfect. One of the best actors in the world, in my opinion.
There's been some statements made about how Terry would be absolutely over the moon about having Michael Sheen and David Tennant play those roles. And it's interesting, though, because Neil Gaiman, who has scripted all six episodes for the series, he went on Twitter after learning of the casting saying, "You go down to the bottom of the garden to write and leave your phone behind, and then something like this happens." He only agreed to adapt to Good Omens after reading a letter sent posthumously to him by Pratchett, which we already know about. But he also wrote Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's Good Omens. "My job as executive producer on Good Omens is primarily to remind the world the book had two fecking authors."
This is something that's been rattling around in development hell for a very long time, of course, Good Omens, and it was going to be made as a film by Terry Gilliam for quite a long time.
Yes, Terry Gilliam's a big fan of the book. Have you read Good Omens yet?
I have, yeah. A long time ago. My memories of it aren't very fresh, but I did really enjoy it.
I love the idea of that most English of apocalypses.
Yes. I think that is the part of the reason why I'm happy about this is that it is, for all it's co-funded by Amazon, it's also a BBC co-production.
Yeah.
And I do think it has a better chance of keeping that kind of parochial, self-effacing quality better than a film, even a film made by someone like Gilliam, who I think is a genius, would have been able to do.
I mean, the other thing I like about, the other thing I'm curious about, I should say, with Good Omens is, because you do have those cutaway scenes that deal with Agnes Nutter.
Yes.
Because all of it is centered around the nice and accurate prophecies of Agnes Nutter. And nice and accurate, I should clarify for people who haven't read Good Omens, according to the way it was described in the book, accurate literally means what it says, you know, precise.
Mm.
Nice, on the other hand, does not mean nice as in the way we would normally define nice.
Pleasant, yeah. You know,
not pleasant or anything like that. What it means is also kind of accurate. These are they're astute, precise, defined. So they're very, very, very precise prophecies of the future. A lot more so than Nostradamus.
Nostradamus hit it big, didn't he? Because he realised that as long as your prophecies are vague enough, people will read anything into them. It's a pretty good racket.
Oh, yeah. I might get into that gig.
In fact, yeah. Why have we not started a Geek Show prophecy podcast? We could start it now, Rob.
What, just telling the future?
The egg will revolve around the frozen pond until daffodils rain from the yearning mouth of Seraphim's tears. There we go, that's World War III for you.
The roll of toilet tissue has unspooled in a specific way. I don't know.
That's not a prophecy so much as it is sort of your main annoyance this morning, isn't it?
The giant ball of elastic bands has bounced irregularly. War is coming.
You could do a sort of being there thing where you just talk about petty domestic problems and let everyone else think of them as being massively significant. My dog has been sick on the carpet again. Oh, right, clearly nuclear tensions between North and South Korea are going to flare up again.
Oh, that does tie in with something I tell my nephew all of the time. I keep saying to him, the world is screaming information at you. All you have to do is just pay attention and just use your eyes and ears, you know, see and hear, and you'll actually start understanding certain things. He's like, but he's not saying anything to me. I'm like, that's because you got your headphones on and you're playing a video game. So, yeah.
That's a touching moral that brings to a close the tale of our brief experiment in prophecy.
Exactly.
Man, we go off ideas pretty quick nowadays, don't we? It's literally the point at which we realise it's going to take work.
Yes, it is going to take work. Lots of work.
And, you know, without hard work, you can't do a lot of things. You can't start a family. You can't start your own business. You can't buy your own home, Rob, which is a shame.
Yeah.
But there is a very special home on the market right now.
I like the way you did that.
Yes.
It was better than my attempted segue earlier about tax.
That had a certain kind of angular appeal, I think. But yeah, a very desirable property in Lavenham in Suffolk has just gone on the market let me just see if I can find the price, just shy of £1 million with Carter Jonas, who I believe was a boy band star in the 90s.
Either that or he was he had like a cameo in Miami Vice.
That would be great, being shown around your house by a guy in a cream jacket with the sleeves rolled up. But yes, this property is not just any old house, and Carter Jonas is not, well, it could be just any other estate agent, I don't know, but this house is definitely special because it's Harry Potter's childhood home in Godric Hollow.
But it's not in Godric Hollow.
It's true, yeah. I assume that's like the old English word for Lavenham in Suffolk.
Possibly.
It's called De Vere House. It has the second most photographed doorway in Britain after the portal into hell that is number 10 Downing Street.
Hang on, the second most photographed doorway?
Yes.
Who the hell goes around taking photos of doorways?
You say that, but I bet there is a massive underground doorway photographing ring operating in Britain under our very noses.
I'm sorry, but... No, brain, stop. Stop, my brain. I just got like... You remember how Soho used to be during like the 70s and early 80s?
Oh, yes.
You know? Now I've just got neon signs going, sexy doorways, live doorways.
It's funny you should say this, because when John Ronson was going around Stanley Kubrick's archives for one of his Guardian pieces,
yeah,
he found a photograph of his own front door.
Oh. What?
And it turned out that Kubrick had sent a location scout all around London trying to find the perfect prostitute's door for a scene in Eyes Wide Shut.
And his doorway was a candidate.
John Ronson's doorway was on the shortlist. There's something particularly sexy and illicit about the door to John Ronson's house, apparently.
Oh, God. No, Brian, just stop there. No jokes about entries.
I'm only going to turn the screws further as the show goes on.
Oh, I don't think I'm going to survive.
The thing about Godric Hollow is it's this really rickety-looking, old-fashioned house, and to be honest, it looks like it's going to fall down in a collapse into a pile of cinders at any minute to me, but hey-o.
I'll be honest, looking at it from the front, it looks a bit lopsided.
Yes.
I mean, the right-hand side of the house just looks like that room is going to collapse under the weight of the room above.
It does. But the strangest thing about it to me is that you've got this thing that looks like it was made sometime before the Norman invasion of England. And right next to it, you've just got modern Tevest House in this disgusting orange colour.
I know.
I mean, I bet that thing does not even rank in the top 100 most photographed doorways.
Then again.
Suppose if Kubrick's about, you never know.
Well, no. Maybe this was it, De Vere House, Godric's Hollow, whatever you want to call it. Maybe that's like the high class version, but next door is just, you know, the streetwalker. I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
Shall we move on to our second Harry Potter story?
Yes, and I think this one's. What can I say about this one? I don't know.
It's basically about how Harry Potter is now an enemy of the owls.
Yeah, I know. That's the disturbing thing. Asia has an obsession with Harry Potter. Not sure why, because from like Indonesia to India, wild birds are getting sold as pets to families who want to own Hedwig.
Mm.
And that line disturbs the hell out of me.
Oh.
Because before Harry Potter, before J.K. Rowling, I watched a movie called Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
If you don't know about this movie, listeners, why not Google it at work with the safe search off?
6 inches born and 5 inches back, I have an angry inch. If you watch the movie, that will need no explanation, okay?
I bet J.K. Rowling is actually a big fan of Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I read that line that there's, you know, there's families who want their own Hedwig, my brain's not thinking of the owl.
No.
But yeah, the Harry Potter obsession has become an actual danger to owls.
Yeah. This is being reported in a sort of interesting way, isn't it? Because they're saying, in Asia, they're obsessed with Harry Potter, and you think, and in Britain, we're not. Do you think this is one of those things where Asians actually like something in exactly the same way that Westerners do, but because it's the East, we all think, oh, those Japanese, those Indonesians, they're crazy. They've become so obsessed with pop culture. Now, back to binge-watching Game of Thrones.
Yep. Well, here's the thing. Whenever, here in Middlesbrough, they sometimes bring one of the bird sanctuaries or places like that. They'll bring a bunch of birds into the town centre, and you'll see all the kids looking at these birds of prey, these huge owls and, you know, eagles and stuff like that, that could take a small child and tear it into pieces.
Yes.
And you think, you're letting kids near this? Isn't that a bit like saying to a kid, go pet the lion, it's okay.
Of course, Middlesbrough has a deep and abiding link with owls because of our greatest resident, doesn't it?
I don't know.
Have you not seen the Middlesbrough Owl Man?
No.
He's a guy, and I think his superhero origin story was that his house caught fire and he had owls in there. And after that, he vowed never to let the owls out of his sight. So he drives around Middlesbrough on a mobility scooter that festooned with live owls.
I actually know the guy. And now I know. See, when you said the Middlesbrough owl man, I was thinking, is there some guy dressed up as an owl and trying to be a vigilante in Middlesbrough?
There's a Cornish owl man. People in Cornwall in the 70s believed that they saw a terrifying owl-human hybrid.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking of somebody dressed as an owl.
No, the Middlesbrough owl man, it always brightens my day when I see that guy around.
Yeah, I'm always concerned about the state of his mobility scooter.
Does it get a bit of bird detritus on it? Does the bird leave presents, shall we say?
Well, at certain points you might as well call it a guano-mobile. And don't get me wrong, he's going around raising money for charity, stuff like that, and credit to him for doing that, but they are birds, and birds do poop.
That could be the title of your children's novel. Birds do poop.
I think Pratchett beat me to it when he did the book of poo.
I didn't know that one, but Pratchett beats everyone to everything.
Yes, he does. I can't remember what the full title is. I'm going to have to Google this because the title is kind of glorious. The World of Poo. That's what it's called. I don't know what to say about it.
Shall we move on to a book idea that Terry Pratchett did not have?
Yes, a book idea that Terry Pratchett didn't have. French illustrator Jim Jardin actually did have. Or rather, it's not so much a book with a narrative itself, although some of these do tell a story, a very, very specific story. A couple of years ago, a bunch of scientists on Twitter started describing their research mishaps as fieldwork fails. So if you go onto Twitter and go hashtag fieldwork fail, you'll find that science is a kind of a messy process. A lot messier than people think.
Yes. Right?
Jim Jardin collected a bunch of these together and has illustrated them. And has, after a successful Kickstarter campaign, is releasing a book called Fieldwork Fail. Now, the book is presented very much in the way a kid's book would be presented, but with some slight disturbing things that definitely aren't for kids, like Jeff Stratford released a goldfinch, Mr. Flappy, that was immediately captured by a falcon in front of 24 horrified middle school girls. Hashtag fieldwork fails.
No, hang on. He stood in front of a crowd of middle school girls and said, "All right, I'm going to release Mr. Flappy."
Yes.
I mean, that's a failure to start with.
Yeah, but as soon as he let it out, a falcon comes down and catches it. But this one is one of my favourites. Angela Bayona,
yes.
Accidentally pee on a Jaguar's marked tree, get chased by the Jaguar for 3 weeks. Might sound exciting, actually quite scary. Hashtag fieldwork fail. My first question is, how do you accidentally pee on a Jaguar's marked tree?
To be fair, I think that's fairly easy. You need to pee. You go on a tree. You fail to check its ownership beforehand.
I've got some others from Twitter, if you want them. When your drugged zebra finds the one tree in the Namibian plains which also has a neck height fork, hashtag fieldwork fail. And there's a glorious picture of these people trying to get this zebra, this drugged zebra who's now fast asleep with its neck in the fork of the tree. Oh, this one's brilliant. Accidentally glued myself to a crocodile while attaching a radio transmitter. Hashtag fieldwork fail.
I mean, that just raises so many questions, doesn't it?
That sinking feeling when you realise you have inadvertently exchanged saliva with a dead jackal. Hashtag fieldwork fail. And that was from Sarah Durand. So, Sarah, wherever you are, We'd like to know more about that story.
This is starting to feel a bit like we're naming and shaming them, really, isn't it?
Oh,
he is one who swapped spit with a dead animal. He is one who released Mr. Flappy in front of a group of schoolgirls.
Yeah. Spilled dirty ethanol and clove oil down front of wetsuit. Had to pretend I wasn't getting chemical burns when talking to crew. Hashtag failed work fail.
Why do these all sound like some sort of horrific fetish thing?
I don't know.
Is that just what science is now? It's people who can't admit to themselves that they've got a really specific kink, so they pretend that they're actually learning something.
Oh, this one fits exactly what you just said. This one does fit what you just said. Lick tiny object to discern if fossil or rock. Fossil. Sticks to tongue. Coughing fit from dust. Sharp inhale. Swallow fossil. Hashtag fieldwork fail.
See, that's a running gag on Doctor Who, that the Doctor can just sort of stick his tongue out and work out what either it is.
Exactly.
Humans can't do that. That's the joke.
I know. Here's a great one. Getting the ZSL science truck stuck in a river in the middle of Mongolia while searching for bats. Hashtag fieldwork fail.
This is really diminishing the image of science in my eyes, I've got to admit.
And one glorious one, just to round us off. When you are collecting cheetah poo and drop some on yourself. And this has two hashtags, hashtag fieldwork fail and hashtag distractingly sexy.
What?
That's why I will save that one for last.
That, wow. I think by comparison to this, the next story I have is actually the clean one of the show.
Exactly.
Yes. A new study has shown, get the bleeper ready for this.
Yeah.
That there is a dramatic growth of swearing in American novels, which, in fairness, it says dramatic. It also says over the last 60 years, which, I mean, you'd expect, right?
Well, it depends on what you define as swearing.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, Rob. Led by Gene Twenge, whose surname is, I think, an obscure swear word itself.
Yeah, I was about to say it.
You absolute twenge.
Yes.
Gene Twenge, author and psychology professor at San Diego State University. The team analysed the titles making up the Google Books corpus of American English books published between 1950 and 2008, looking for use of the words and tip. They picked these words because they were described as seven words you can never say on television by comedian George Carlin in 1972.
You do realise I'm going to bleep all of those.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
Which is going to be hilarious.
Yes. Also bleep out the word twenge. Overall, they found that writers were significantly more likely to use each of the seven swear words in the years since 1950, with books published, this is interesting, in 2005 to 2008 were 28 times more likely to include swear words than books published in the early 1950s. I think that's interesting, because why the cut-off point in 2008? Was it the case that when Obama was elected, American authors just sort of calmed down a bit?
Well,
now it's about to skyrocket again.
I think one of the problems is that there are certain words that they can't use now that there was a black president.
Mm.
You know,
hello.
Yeah.
You say that leads us nicely onto last year's Man Booker Prize winner, The Sellout by American novelist Paul Beatty, nonetheless managed to shock a number of book reviewers because of the sheer volume of expletives inside, including more than 80 instances of and more than 90 uses of the N-word.
Wow. But then again, have you listened to gangster rap?
I was going to say, 90 uses of the N-word is like a full Tarantino, isn't it?
Well, I'd say it's kind of a 50 Cent video, isn't it?
Yes. It's a song by N.W.A.
Basically, it's a word. Yes, it's a derogatory word, but it's still just a word. Do you know what I think has happened, right?
Mm.
What I think has happened is that over the last almost 70 years, the language has changed a lot. And we have a lot of words. They're basically talking about specific words here. And they're obviously, you know, these are words that have been derogatory terms or expletives for a while.
Yeah.
But I think one of the problems that's happened is we've normalized certain words already, you know.
Yeah.
We don't really see shit as an expletive anymore. It's like the word bastard. A lot of people.
I was going to mention bastard because when I was growing up, that was a really harsh swear word. And yet now, I'm not even going to bleep that because.
Yeah, because the thing is, it is an actual word. It has a proper meaning. It literally means an illegitimate child.
Yeah.
You know, that's the actual meaning. It's like the word. Right?
Mm.
People don't realise that is a type of goldfish.
Yes. I am going to bleep that, but I would like it if listeners could actually work out what that meant through the mention of goldfish. I think that would be the audience I'd appreciate the most.
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember. I think it was it a male or female goldfish?
I would imagine, given the words or the usage.
Oh, no, it's a pregnant goldfish, sorry.
Yes. It's interesting that sort of a lot of the sort of discourse about both shows which the conservative end of the media find offensive or books which the conservative end of the media find offensive and things that those same outlets consider to be political correctness gone mad, all of this makes a lot of sense, more sense when you realise that we are not becoming a more liberal society or a less shockable society. It's just that the taboos we have are realigning.
Yeah,
I mean, even the Guardian article that I'm reading out, which uses the word c**t and m**t, actually says the N-word.
Thing is, the boundaries are always shifting because our sensibilities as humans, what we like and dislike, that's always changing. That Emmett Brown says in Back to the Future.
Oh.
But it applies to everybody. You could easily replace the word kids with people. It says to Marty McFly, kids don't change, Marty, only the background changes. But yes. Replace that with people, and people don't change, only the background changes.
I think that's completely true. I think also measuring this from 1950 is one of those things where I'd be sort of shocked if I didn't see a 28-fold rise, because I think it was 1948 when Norman Mailer wrote The Naked and the Dead. He wanted to write a very gritty and honest novel about his experiences in the army, but he was told by his publishers that he couldn't say fuck. He had to spell it fug, F-U-G. And when he met the actress and famous bon vivant Tallulah Bankhead at the launch party for his book, someone said, oh, this is Norman, he wrote the book. And Bankhead turned to him and went, oh, you're that young man who can't spell fuck.
See, if he'd turned up with a t-shirt that just said fug life.
Yes. Ahead of his time there.
Exactly.
So maybe we are overusing modern colloquial dialect words.
See,
maybe.
I want us to return to a more traditional set of values. Call me conservative if you want, but I think we should bring back mutton shunter.
Mutton shunter still sounds genuinely obscene, doesn't it?
Exactly. instead of mutton shunter has much more meaning.
I like that melon farmer has almost become kind of its own legitimate slang term now.
Yes.
I've heard that used quite a lot when, you know, you can't say what it represents, which we can't, although we have several times in this show. But fortunately, there are some new words, or rather some very old words that are coming in to fill the space in our dialect left by the overuse of swear words. Some of Britain's more obscure dialect words, including cheeselog, dimpsy, bobola, and twitten,
the hell is a cheese log?
Daren't ask, really. I think it's what we thought Chuck Palahniuk was leaving in the walls of his house.
Oh, it's a woodlouse. But why don't you call it a woodlouse? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've just sort of got it here. Yes, they have a bobble of it, a large moth, which I like very much.
I know, there's a bobola flying at my head.
There are two that mean alleyway, and they're both rather good. Ginnel and Twitten mean alleyway. The one that I am most perplexed by, Diddlem, means community savings scheme.
What?
I mean, who needs a single word for community savings scheme?
I'm going to put my money in the Diddlem. It sounds like something that Ned Flanders would say.
It sounds like something else to me.
We need to secure the Diddlem.
Yes, put on an extra pair of pants.
No, we need to invest the Diddlem wisely.
Yes, don't go just spending your Diddlem around any which way. Some of these, being a northerner, I was more than aware of, like Mardy for Moody or Gert for Great. Those are gettable. I think some of them, my favourite one is one where it's just, you can see the etymology in it. A word for lopsided or wonky, or rather a term for lopsided or wonky, is on the huh.
On the huh?
On the huh? It's good, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's from Suffolk. People in Berkshire, they refer to woodlice as cheese log, so blame them. Cumbrians refer to complaining as twining.
I thought it was just an everyday thing in Cumbria. I didn't think they needed any special word for it.
Yes, it's just dialogue in Cumbria, really, isn't it?
Just everyday conversation, man.
People in Devonshire refer to the twilight as dimpsy. It's getting dimpsy out there.
I'm sorry, but there was that old cop show during the 80s called Dempsey and Mabies.
Dimpsy and cheese log.
Exactly.
That's with the Captain most Diddlem.
With Captain Diddlem.
It's the most incomprehensible rural detective show yet, even more so than Twin Peaks.
Exactly. Do you know what I find? Do you know what I find funniest about this article? Is the picture of Kanye West and Taylor Swift, which doesn't.
Every time we look at a story on the Daily Telegraph, it has some sort of picture or cultural connection where you think, that's not going to mean anything to Daily Telegraph readers.
Exactly.
In case you're wondering, listeners, they were illustrating the concept of gegging in or butting in the local dialogue of Merseyside. But I think the picture of Kanye West and Taylor Swift is liable to confuse Telegraph readers more than even the most obscure local dialect ever could.
Yes. See, I look at that and I'm thinking, I am very, very confused about what you're trying to tell me. And then I read it's gegging in, and I'm like, that's not gegging in. What the hell? We know that's just Kanye being Kanye.
It's liable to confuse and frighten Daily Telegraph readers with evidence that black people and white people are allowed on the same stage these days.
What? What? This is a travesty, I tell you.
They'll be desegregating South Africa next.
We shall fight them in the fields. Sorry, Churchill wasn't like that, I know.
He was a bit, wasn't he, if we're honest?
He was. Anyway, to finish it off today, I was going to do The Iron Hand by Tim Akers, but I have been enjoying reading it a lot, but I haven't actually finished, so I'm going to save that for the next show. But we do have an interesting thing to finish off with. Now, You know how there are a lot of Pokemon fans?
Hmm.
And Pokemon Go is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah.
Well, there is a book coming out, right? It started up on, it was put up on Kickstarter in October 2016. It's an encyclopedia of life, but for Pokemon. It's called Pokenatomy, an unofficial guide to the science of Pokemon. And it is, let's put it this way, this is not a book that you would get for your children who love Pokemon.
No, or anyone.
Well, it depends on how much you love Pokemon. If you've reached the point of loving Pokemon to a disturbing degree, maybe you want this book. How do I explain Pokenatomy?
It's sort of like incredible cross-sections, but for people who have always dreamed of dissecting Jigglypuff.
Yes. And it goes through the original 150 Pokemon in a very, very disturbing way.
Does that mean, if it's in the original set, does that mean it's got Porygon in it?
Yes.
Does that, will it have a special gland to cause photosensitive epilepsy?
I don't know, but apparently, where was it, the Pikachu becomes sexually mature at a certain age?
Oh, God, yeah.
And you just think, why? There's even a picture of a Diglett, but apparently part of it's censored. It might be exposed in the book. I don't know. The underground part of it is apparently censored.
These are words that should never be said on television.
These are words that should never be said about Pokemon.
Yes.
I mean, they've got Jigglypuff there, which is a cute round pink ball with a curl, as if it was Clark Kent before it becomes Superman, right? And that is on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side is Jigglypuff's skull and internal organs and hollow eye socket. And you just think, one half looks like something horrific from one of those really shoddy, horrible 80s horrors, and the other side looks like Pokemon. And I'm sorry, but if anyone did Pokemon zombies, this is what they'd look like. All I can say about Pokenatomy is I will not be buying it for any of my nephews or nieces who like Pokemon, because at the end of the day, as much as I don't really care about Pokemon, I don't care about it enough to hate it or like it or anything like that, but it keeps them quiet for a while, right?
Yeah.
And peace is good. I don't want to give them nightmares about being chased by a Pikachu that with half its body missing and just its bones and organs showing.
Freshly skinned Pikachu.
I'm sorry, but you remember The Rescuers Down Under?
I do. I think that was the first film I saw at the cinema.
Right. The Rescuers Down Under had that trapper hunter guy, and he had that song, Home, Home on the Range, his own version of it, where the critters are tied up in chains. I'll rip off their hides and check what's inside, and the next day I'll do it again. Or words to that effect. And I'm like, that is a deeply disturbing song. You are a deeply disturbed man. And I think that this is kind of the same.
It's got a target market of that guy.
The psycho. Yes.
Yeah.
That guy over there who's strangely obsessed with Pokemon and wants them to really exist. Stop. Stop looking at it. It's like a car crash.
Yes.
Take it away from me. Yes.
Shall we draw a discreet veil over such things?
Yes, let's have a couple more hashtag fieldwork fails.
Oh, nice idea.
Just to, so we can wash out that aftertaste. Skillfully applied $1,000 satellite tag to manta ray. The same manta ray I tagged yesterday. So now it's got two. Caught fuel line in outboard prop. Spent hours drifting, cleaning carb, and dodging angry hippos. It's 2 o'clock and dark. Discovering secret granola stash in field station equals loads of presents, everybody's happy. Realizing later, flax seeds, actually weevils. And finally, when you spill pheromone solution on yourself and become the sexiest damn Tanner Beetle in all skin. Hashtag fieldwork fail. Hashtag, and this time deservingly, hashtag distractingly sexy.
Yes.
Sorry, that is just the best one. So anyway, on that note, all you sexy Tanner Beetles out there, we're going to leave you. We'll be back soon with a couple of book reviews. Hopefully Graham will have some Valerian to talk about. I will definitely have The Iron Hound by Tim Akers, which I've been looking forward to for a while. If you want to catch up with the previous coverage of The Iron Hound, look for the show relating to it. I can't remember the name of that particular episode, so just explore. There's also an interview that I did with Tim Akers himself, which you'll find on the Geek Show's channel. It will be under Meandering Mike. Literary Loitering is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network, and all of our shows are available on Audioboom, iTunes, or the podcast provider of your choice. So if you are listening to any of those, subscribe, and it'll keep you up to date with everything that we're doing, all of the podcasts and the network, that sort of thing. We also have a Patreon up and running, which we will be using to buy essential equipment and cover the costs of us taking things to the next level, which is YouTube. There'll be more YouTube content coming. So if you are a regular listener, then please be generous and sign up to our Patreon. All of the help will be greatly appreciated. Yes. And that's about it for the info dump. I have been Rob.
I've been Graham.
Until next time, we'll see. I was going so well. Damn it.
And then you just started thinking about Jigglypuff's innards.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. Until next time on Literary Loitering. Which is what I was trying to do originally. We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.